But if they happen to pass close to one of the larger planets, they may be compelled to change their open curves to ellipses and become comets of short period. This is the theory of capture. Comets of long periods or of no period are dislodged from their paths to become short-period comets. What the origin of the long-period comets is remains an unanswered question. The short-period comets apparently have some relation to the larger planets. About 50 comets move between the Sun and the orbit of Jupiter, their periods are under 9 years. 4 comets reach the orbit of Saturn, 2 comets revolve inside the circle described by Uranus, and 9 comets, with an average period of 71 years, move within the orbit of Neptune. These comprise the system of the short-period comets as it is known at present. To the last group belongs the Halley comet, which, among the comets of short periods, has the longest period of revolution, about 76 years. Then there is a great gap, after which there are comets that require thousands of years before they return to the Sun, if they return at all. The distribution of the short-period comets suggested the idea that they were captured by the large planets. This theory has for its support the direct observation that comets are disturbed on their path by the planets. Another theory of the comets supposes their origin to have been in the Sun, but in a manner unlike that conceived of in the tidal theory of the origin of planets. Mighty whirls on the surface of the Sun sweep ignited gases into great protuberances. These are observed daily. Matter is driven off from the Sun and returns to the Sun. It is calculated that if the velocity of the ejection were to exceed 384 miles per second, the speed of motion in a parabola, the matter would not return to the Sun but would become a long-range comet. Then the path of the ejected mass might become perturbed as a result of its passage near one of the larger planets, and the comet would become one of a short period. Birth of a comet in this manner has never been observed, and the probability that matter in explosion may reach a speed of 384 miles per second is highly questionable. It was therefore supposed alternatively that millions of years ago, when the activity of their gaseous masses was more dynamic, the large planets expelled comets from their bodies. The speed required for the ejected mass to overcome the gravitational pull of the ejecting body is less in the case of the planets than in the case of the Sun, owing to their smaller gravitational pull. It is calculated that a mass hurled from Jupiter at a speed of about 38 miles per second, or at only a little more than a third of this velocity, in the case of Neptune, would become expelled. This variant of the theory neglects the question of the origin of the long-period comets. However, an explanation was offered, according to which the large planets throw the comets that pass close to them from their short orbits into elongated ones, or even expel them entirely from the solar system. When passing close to the Sun, comets emit tails. It is assumed that the material of the tail does not return to the comet's head but is dispersed in space. Consequently, the comets as luminous bodies must have a limited life. If Halley's comet has pursued its present orbit since late Precambrian times, it must have grown and lost 8 million tails, which seems improbable. If comets are wasted, their number in the solar system must permanently diminish, and no comet of short period could have preserved its tails since geological times. But as there are many luminous comets of short period, they must have been produced or acquired at some time when other members of the system, the planets and the satellites, were already in their places. A theory has been offered that once the solar system moved through a nebula and obtained its comets there, did the Sun emit planets by shrinkage or by tide, and comets by explosion? Did the comets come from interstellar space and were they captured into the solar system by larger planets? Did the larger planets produce the smaller planets by cleavage, or did they expel the short-period comets from their bodies? It is admitted that we cannot know the truth about the origin of the planetary and cometary systems billions of years ago. The problem of the origin and development of the solar system suffers from the label speculative. It is frequently said that as we were not there when the system was formed, we cannot legitimately arrive at any idea of how it was formed. The most we can do, it is believed, is to investigate one planet, the one under our feet, in order to learn its past, and then, by the deductive method, to apply the results to other members of the solar system. Chapter 2, The Planet Earth. The planet Earth has a stony shell, the lithosphere. It consists of igneous rock, like granite and basalt, with sedimentary rock on top. The igneous rock is the original crust of the Earth. Sedimentary rock is deposited by water. The inner composition of the Earth is not known. The propagation of seismic waves gives support to the assumption that the shell of the Earth is over 2,000 miles thick. On the basis of the gravitational effect of mountain masses, the theory of isostasy, the shell is estimated to be only 60 miles thick. The presence of iron in the shell or the migration of heavy metals from the core to the shell has not been sufficiently explained. For these metals to have left the core, they must have been ejected by explosions, and in order to remain spread through the crust, the explosions must have been followed immediately by cooling. If, in the beginning, the planet was a hot conglomerate of elements, as the nebula as well as the tidal theories assume, then the iron of the globe should have become oxidized and combined with all available oxygen. But for some unknown reason this did not take place, thus the presence of oxygen in the terrestrial atmosphere is unexplained. The water of the oceans contains a large amount of soluble sodium chloride, common salt. Sodium might have come from rocks eroded by rain, but rocks are poor in chlorine and the proportion of sodium and chlorine in seawater calls for 50 times more chlorine in the igneous rock than it actually contains. The deep strata of igneous rock contain no signs of fossil life. Encased in sedimentary rock are skeletons of marine and land animals, often in many layers one upon the other. Not infrequently igneous rock is found protruding into sedimentary rock or even covering it over large areas, pointing to successive eruptions of igneous rock that became heated and molten after there was life on the Earth. Upon strata which show no signs of fossil life are strata containing shells, and sometimes the shells are so numerous as to constitute the entire mass of the rock. They are often found in the hardest rock. Higher strata contain skeletons of land animals, often of extinct species, and not infrequently, above the strata with the remains of land animals are other strata with marine fauna. The species of the animals, and even their genera, change with the strata. The strata often assume an oblique position, sometimes being almost vertical. Frequently they are faulted and overturned in many ways. Cuvier, 1769-1832, the founder of vertebrate paleontology, or the science of petrified skeletons of animals possessing vertebrae, from fish to man, was much impressed by the picture presented by the sequence of the layers of Earth. When the traveler passes over these fertile plains where gently flowing streams nourish in their course an abundant vegetation, and where the soil, inhabited by a numerous population, adorned with flourishing villages, opulent cities, and superb monuments, is never disturbed, except by the ravages of war, or by the oppression of the powerful, he is not led to suspect that nature also has had her intestine wars, and that the surface of the globe has been broken up by revolutions and catastrophes. But his ideas change as soon as he digs into that soil which now presents so peaceful an aspect. Cuvier thought that great catastrophes had taken place on this earth, repeatedly changing seabeds into continents and continents into seabeds. He held that genera and species were unchangeable since creation. But, observing different animal remains in various levels of Earth, he concluded that catastrophes must have annihilated life in vast areas, leaving the ground for other forms of life. Where did these other genera come from? Either they were newly created or, more likely, they migrated from other parts of the world, which were not at that time also visited by cataclysms. He could not find the cause of these cataclysms. He saw in their traces the problem in geology it is of most importance to solve, but he realized that in order to resolve it satisfactorily, it would be necessary to discover the cause of these events, an undertaking which presents a difficulty of quite a different kind. He knew only of many fruitless attempts already made, and he did not find himself able to offer a solution. These ideas have haunted, I may almost say have tormented me during my researches among fossil bones. Cuvier's theory of stabilized forms of life and of annihilating catastrophes was supplanted by a theory of evolution in geology, Lyell, and biology, Darwin. The mountains are what is left of plateaus eroded by wind and water in a very slow process. Sedimentary rock is detritus of igneous rock eroded by rain, then carried to sea, and there slowly deposited. Skeletons of birds and of land animals in these rocks are presumed to have belonged to animals that waded close to the shore of the sea in shallow water, died while wading, and were covered by sediment before fish destroyed the cadavers or the water separated the bones of their skeletons. No widespread catastrophes disrupted the slow and steady process. The theory of evolution, which can be traced to Aristotle, and which was the teaching of Lamarck in the days of Cuvier and of Darwin after him, has been generally accepted as truth by natural sciences for almost 100 years. Sedimentary rock covers high mountains and the highest of all, the Himalayas. Shells and skeletons of sea animals are found there. This means that at some early time fish swam over these mountains. What caused the mountains to rise? A force pushing from within or pulling from without or twisting on the sides must have elevated the mountains and lifted continents from the bottom of the sea and submerged other land masses. The process of raising the mountains is supposed to have been very slow and gradual. On the other hand, it is clear that igneous rock, already hard, had to become fluid in order to penetrate sedimentary rock or cover it. It is not known what initiated this process, but it is asserted that it must have happened long before man appeared on the earth. So when skulls of early man are found in late deposits, or skulls of modern man are found together with bones of extinct animals in early deposits, difficult problems are presented. Occasionally, also, during mining operations, a human skull is found in the middle of a mountain, under a thick cover of basalt or granite, like the Calaveras skull of California. Human remains and human artifacts of bone, polished stone, or pottery are found under great deposits of till and gravel, sometimes under as much as 100 feet. The origin of clay, sand, and gravel on igneous and sedimentary rock offers a problem. The theory of ice ages was put forth, 1840, to explain this and other enigmatic phenomena. As far north as Spitzbergen, in the polar circle, at some time in the past, coral reefs were formed, which do not occur except in tropical regions. Palms also grew on Spitzbergen. The continent of Antarctica, which today has not a single tree on it, must have been covered at one time by forests, since it has coal deposits. As we see, the planet Earth is full of secrets. We have not come closer to solving the problem of the origin of the solar system by investigating the planet under our feet. On the contrary, we have found many other unsolved problems concerning the lithosphere, hydrosphere, and atmosphere of the Earth. Shall we be more fortunate if we try to understand the process that caused the changes on the globe in the most recent geological epoch, the time of the last glacial period, a period close to the time which is regarded as historical? Ice ages. Not many thousands of years ago, we are taught, great areas of Europe and of North America were covered with glaciers. Perpetual on the globe we are faced with it. Here is how the question is put concerning the eastern coast of North America. Not long ago in a geological sense, the flat plain from New Jersey to Florida was under the sea. At that time the ocean surf broke directly on the old Appalachian Mountains. Previously the southeastern part of the mountain structure had sunk below the sea and become covered with a layer of sand and mud, thickening seaward. The wedge-like mass of marine sediments was then uplifted and cut into by rivers, giving the Atlantic coastal plain of the United States. Why was it uplifted? To the westward are the Appalachians. The geologist tells us of the stressful times when a belt of rocks extending from Alabama to Newfoundland was jammed, thrust together, to make this mountain system. Why? How was it done? In former times the sea flooded the region of the Great Plains from Mexico to Alaska, and then withdrew. Why this change? The birth of the Cordilleras, again the mystery of mountain-making clamors for solution. And so on all over the world. The Himalayas were under the sea. Now Eurasia is 3 miles or more above the bottom of the Pacific. Why? The problem of mountain making is a vexing one. Many of them, mountains, are composed of tangentially compressed and overthrust rocks that indicates scores of miles of circumferential shortening in the Earth's crust. Radial shrinkage is woefully inadequate to cause the observed amount of horizontal compression. Therein lies the real perplexity of the problem of mountain making. Geologists have not yet found a satisfactory escape from this dilemma. Even authors of textbooks confess their ignorance. Why have sea floors of remote periods become the lofty highlands of today? What generates the enormous forces that bend, break, and mash the rocks in mountain zones? These questions still await satisfactory answers. Ice lay is not only on the slopes of high mountains, but loaded itself in heavy masses upon continents even in moderate latitudes. Where today the Hudson, the Elbe, and the Upper Dnieper flow, there were then frozen deserts. They were like the immense glacier of Greenland that covers that island. There are signs that a retreat of the glaciers was interrupted by a new massing of ice, and that their borders differed at various times. Geologists are able to find the boundaries of the glaciers. Ice moves very slowly, pushing stones before it, and accumulations of stones or moraines remain when the glacier retreats, melting away. Traces have been found of 5 or 6 consecutive displacements of the ice sheet during the Ice Age, or of 5 or 6 glacial periods. Some force repeatedly pushed the ice sheet toward moderate latitudes. Neither the cause of the ice ages nor the cause of the retreat of the icy desert is known. The time of these retreats is also a matter of speculation. Many ideas were offered and guesses made to explain how the glacial epochs originated and why they terminated. Some suppose that the sun at different times emits more or less heat, which causes periods of heat and cold on the Earth, but no evidence that the sun is such a variable star was adduced to support this hypothesis. Others conjectured that cosmic space has warmer and cooler areas, and that when our solar system travels through the cooler areas, ice descends upon latitudes closer to the tropics. But no physical agents were found responsible for such hypothetical cold and warm areas in space. A few wondered whether the precession of the equinoxes or the slow change in the direction of the terrestrial axis might cause periodic variations in the climate. But it was shown that the difference in insulation could not have been great enough to have been responsible for the glacial ages. Still others thought to find the answer in the periodic variations in the eccentricity of the ecliptic, terrestrial orbit, with glaciation at the maximal eccentricity. Some of them supposed that winter in aphelion, the remotest part of the ecliptic, would cause glaciation, and some thought that summer in aphelion would produce that effect. Some scholars thought about the changes in the position of the terrestrial axis. If the planet Earth is rigid, as it is regarded to be, L. Kelvin, the axis could not have shifted in geological times by more than 3 degrees. George Darwin, if it were elastic, it could have shifted up to 10 or 15 degrees in a very slow process. The cause of the ice ages was seen by a few scholars in the decrease of the original heat of the planet. The warm periods between the ice ages were attributed to the heat set free by a hypothetical decomposition of organisms in the strata close to the surface of the ground. The increase and decrease in the action of warm springs were also considered. Others supposed that dust of volcanic origin filled the terrestrial atmosphere and hindered insulation, or, contrariwise, that an increased content of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere obstructed the reflection of heat rays from the surface of the planet. A decrease in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would cause a fall of temperature, Aeneas, but calculations were made to show that this could not be the real cause of the glacial ages, Angstrom. Changes in the direction of warm currents in the Atlantic Ocean were brought into the discussion, and the Isthmus of Panama was theoretically removed to allow the Gulf Stream to pass into the Pacific at the time of the glacial periods. But it was proved that the two oceans were already divided in the Ice Age. Besides, a part of the Gulf Stream would have remained in the Atlantic anyway. The periodic retreats of ice between the glacial periods would have required periodic removal and replacement of the Isthmus of Panama. Other theories of equally hypothetical nature were proposed. But the phenomena held responsible for the changes have not been proved to have existed, or to have been able to produce the effect. All the above-mentioned theories and hypotheses fail if they cannot meet a most important condition. In order for ice masses to have been formed, increased precipitation must have taken place. This requires an increased amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, which is the result of increased evaporation from the surface of oceans, but this could be caused by heat only. A number of scientists pointed out this fact, and even calculated that in order to produce a sheet of ice as large as that of the Ice Age, the surface of all the oceans must have evaporated to a depth of many feet. Such an evaporation of oceans followed by a quick process of freezing, even in moderate latitudes, would have produced the ice ages. The problem is, what could have caused the evaporation and immediately subsequent freezing? As the cause of such quick alternation of heating and freezing of large parts of the globe is not apparent, it is conceded that at present the cause of excessive ice making on the lands remains a baffling mystery, a major question for the future reader of Earth's riddles. Not only are the causes of the appearance and later disappearance of the glacial sheet unknown, but the geographical shape of the area covered by ice is also a problem. Why did the glacial sheet, in the southern hemisphere, move from the tropical regions of Africa toward the south polar region and not in the opposite direction? And, similarly, why, in the northern hemisphere, did the ice move in India from the equator towards the Himalaya mountains and the higher latitudes? Why did the glaciers of the Ice Age cover the greater part of North America and Europe, while the north of Asia remained free? In America, the plateau of ice stretched up to latitude 40 degrees and even passed across this line. In Europe, it reached latitude 50 degrees, while northeastern Siberia, above the polar circle, even above latitude 75 degrees, was not covered with this perennial ice. All hypotheses regarding increased and diminished insulation due to solar alterations or the changing temperature of the cosmic space, and other similar hypotheses, cannot avoid being confronted with this problem. Glaciers are formed in the regions of eternal snow. For this reason, they remain on the slopes of the high mountains. The north of Siberia is the coldest place in the world. Why did not the Ice Age touch this region, whereas it visited the basin of the Mississippi and all Africa south of the equator? No satisfactory solution to this question has been proposed. The mammoths. Northeast Siberia, which was not covered by ice in the Ice Age, conceals another enigma. The climate there has apparently changed drastically since the end of the Ice Age, and the yearly temperature has dropped many degrees below its previous level. Animals once lived in this region that do not live there now, and plants grew there that are unable to grow there now. The change must have occurred quite suddenly. The cause of this climaster has not been explained. In this catastrophic change of climate and under mysterious circumstances, all the mammoths of Siberia perished. The mammoth belonged to the family of elephants. Its tusks were sometimes as much as 10 feet long. Its teeth were highly developed and their density was greater than in any other stage in the evolution of the elephants. Apparently, they did not succumb in the struggle for survival as an unfit product of evolution. The extinction of the mammoth is thought to have coincided with the end of the last glacial period. Tusks of mammoths have been found in large numbers in northeast Siberia. This well-preserved ivory has been an object of export to China and Europe ever since the Russian conquest of Siberia and was exploited in even earlier times. In modern times, the ivory market of the world still found its main source of supply in the tundras of northeast Siberia. In 1799, the frozen bodies of mammoths were found in these tundras. The corpses were well preserved, and the sledge dogs ate the flesh unharmed. The flesh is fibrous and marbled with fat and looks as fresh as well-frozen beef. What was the cause of their death and the extinction of their race? Cuvier wrote of the extinction of the mammoths, "Repeated eruptions and retreats of the sea have neither all been slow nor gradual. On the contrary, most of the catastrophes which have occasioned them have been sudden, and this is especially easy to be proved with regard to the last of these catastrophes, that which, by a twofold motion, has inundated, and afterwards laid dry, our present continents, or at least a part of the land which forms them at the present day. In the northern regions it has left the carcasses of large quadrupeds which became enveloped in the ice, and have thus been preserved even to our own times, with their skin, their hair, and their flesh. If they had not been frozen as soon as killed, they would have been decomposed by putrefaction. And, on the other hand, this eternal frost could not previously have occupied the places in which they have been seized by it, for they could not have lived in such a temperature. It was, therefore, at one and the same moment that these animals were destroyed and the country which they inhabited became covered with ice. This event has been sudden, instantaneous, without any gradation, and what is so clearly demonstrated with respect to this last catastrophe, is not less so with reference to those which have preceded it. The theory of repeated catastrophes annihilating life on this planet and repeated creations or restorations of life, offered by De Luc III and expanded by Cuvier, did not convince the scientific world. Like Lamarck before Cuvier, Darwin after him thought that an exceedingly slow evolutional process governs genetics, and that there were no catastrophes interrupting this process of infinitesimal changes. According to the theory of evolution, these minute changes came as a result of adaptation to living conditions in the struggle of the species for survival. Like the theories of Lamarck and Darwin, which postulate slow changes in animals, with tens of thousands of years required for a minute step in evolution, the geological theories of the 19th century, and of the 20th as well, regard the geological processes as exceedingly slow and dependent on erosion by rain, wind, and tides. Darwin admitted that he was unable to find an explanation for the extermination of the mammoth, an animal better developed than the elephant which survived. But in conformity with the theory of evolution, his followers supposed that a gradual sinking of the land forced the mammoths to the hills, where they found themselves isolated by marshes. However, if geological processes are slow, the mammoths would not have been trapped on the isolated hills. Besides, this theory cannot be true because the animals did not die of starvation. In their stomachs and between their teeth, undigested grass and leaves were found. This, too, proves that they died from a sudden cause. Further investigations showed that the leaves and twigs found in their stomachs do not now grow in the regions where the animals died, but far to the south, 1,000 or more miles away. It is apparent that the climate has changed radically since the death of the mammoths, and as the bodies of the animals were found not decomposed but well preserved in blocks of ice, the change in temperature must have followed their death very closely or even caused it. There remains to be added that after storms in the Arctic, tusks of mammoths are washed up on the shores of Arctic islands. This proves that a part of the land where the mammoths lived and were drowned is covered by the Arctic Ocean. The Ice Age and the Antiquity of Man. The mammoth lived in the Age of Man. Man pictured it on the walls of caves. Remains of men have repeatedly been found in Central Europe together with remains of mammoths. Occasionally the settlements of the Neolithic man of Europe are found strewn with the bones of mammoths. Man moved southward when Europe was covered with ice and returned when the ice retreated. Historical man witnessed great variation in climate. The mammoth of Siberia, the meat of which is still fresh, is supposed to have been destroyed at the end of the last glacial period, simultaneously with the mammoths of Europe and Alaska. If this is so, the Siberian mammoth was also the contemporary of a rather modern man. At a time when in Europe, close to the ice sheet, man was still in the later stages of Neolithic culture, in the Near and Middle East, the region of the great cultures of antiquity, he may already have progressed well into the Metal Age. There exists no chronological table of Neolithic culture because the art of writing was invented approximately at the advent of the Copper, the early period of the Bronze Age. It is presumed that the Neolithic man of Europe left pictures but no inscriptions, and consequently there are no means of determining the end of the Ice Age in terms of chronology. Geologists have tried to find the time of the end of the last glacial period by measuring the detritus carried by rivers from the glaciers and the deposits of detritus in lakes, the quantity carried by the Rhone from the glaciers of the Alps and the amount on the bottom of the Lake of Geneva, through which the Rhone flows, were calculated, and from the figures obtained the time and velocity of the retreat of the glacial sheet of the last glacial period were estimated. According to the Swiss scholar François Forel, 12,000 years have passed since the time the ice sheet of the last glacial period began to melt, an unexpectedly low figure, as it was thought that the ice age ended 30 to 50,000 years ago.